Mr. David Hopkinson, you were born on the 14th of August 1926 and educated at Wellington College and Merton, Oxford. Could you start by giving me a brief resume of your working career after leaving school?
Well, I went up to Oxford in the war, and then I went to the Navy for 2 or 3 years, and then I went back to Oxford and didn't take a degree because I went straight to the House of Commons, and then I took a degree from the House of Commons. So I've got a war degree, a very distinguished war degree. Not many people have got these. I was a clerk of the House of Commons for 12 years, from 48 to 60. Then I went to Fleming's for 3 years, managing funds. Then for 24 years at M&G, I was running the investment side for the first 15, and then for the last 9, running the whole group. Then I retired very sensibly and became chairman of this company, Harrison's and Crossfield. I was already deputy chairman of English China Clays, and I'm a director of Wolverhampton and Dudley Breweries, and lots of church things like the church commissioners and my own diocese, and trustee of endless sort of charitable artistic things.
How did a firm like M&G organise the dealing side of its activities?
Well, each of the managers of a fund did his own dealing. No centralised dealing. No research. I abolished the research department, so that the investment managers had to actually do their own research, and so they would buy and sell stocks on their own information and on their own responsibility. So they were much more deeply involved, and by not having centralized dealing, each manager knew what he was prepared to pay, or how fast he wanted to go, or how slow he wanted to go.
Was that different to the way other funds would have organized
Yes,
their dealing?
most of large institutions had centralized dealing, and certainly had research departments, and on the whole, probably much more central direction. The whole of M&G was run on a tremendously delegated way, so that each manager had his own objectives, and within the overall policy laid down for him by the board, he was free to get on with it.
Did that mean that the fund managers developed their own network of
Yes.
contacts and sources of
Yes.
information?
Certain managers would be more friendly with certain brokers and individuals, because of the advantage of markets then was that it was very personal. You knew your stockbrokers, you knew who you could trust, whose judgment was good, and you knew which ones dealt well for you. And in those days, of course, the stockbrokers were one's agents, and they weren't working for the enemy, at least you hope they weren't.
Had fund management actually changed terribly much in the, say, between the period you'd been with Fleming and then towards the latter stages of M&G?
Yes, I think it had got very much more specialist and more professional, and a fund manager had become a much more independent-minded person. At least ours had. My job was to create independent-minded people. And for this, you didn't necessarily need intellectual distinction. It was a help, obviously, but common sense and a nice.
Could you elaborate a bit more on what you meant when you said it had become more professional?
I think the whole city became more professional. I'm not saying that that necessarily led to better results, but there was obviously more research, more analytical work, more, yeah, general study of economics and things like this.
Mm.
I actually happen to believe that a successful investment is done by the seat of your pants, and that too much research and all this is actually a hindrance.
Mm.
I mean, it got more and more complicated because there was so much research you couldn't find the wood for the trees, which actually always brought me back to the fact that the individual manager would be well advised to choose the people he trusted and deal with them and use his own judgment. And very occasionally you got managers inside the group taking opposing views, and as long as they didn't buy and sell shares through the market rather than between themselves, I didn't fuss about this, because you want the policies of the funds were different, and you want men of authority running funds.
What kind of backgrounds did your fund managers come from?
Well, they were all sorts. Some were university, some were public schools, some were grammar schools. One of the most successful of all had just started as a blue button in the market and graduated in that way. No, there was no there's no rule of thumb about that. Whether the chap has got nous, actually.
And did you grow them up within the firm, or would they come from outside other careers?
We didn't. We failed to train people for the first 3 or 4 years, say, from 20 to 25. We were bad at that. And then we gave up, and we found that it was much better to employ somebody who had already achieved some experience.
Mm.
The ideal age to take people on, in my view, was 26 or 27.
Mm. Mm. You've already mentioned some of the qualities you thought were necessary to be a fund manager. Was there a particular skill involved, as, for example, distinct from the skill of a merchant banker or of a broker or even of a jobber?
Oh, I think the particular skill was being well informed and having a sense of smell. And we were running an extremely sensitive intelligence outfit. I mean, the managers would go visiting throughout the country, because we dealt with more provincial brokers, I think, than anyone else. And actually going round listening and smelling out was the most valuable thing of all. I mean, whether the managing director of a company had three wives or drank too much was really quite significant information. And whether they all had six-course lunches and fountains were playing, and all this sort of thing that people have talked about. But I think this probably still applies. And the provincial stockbrokers actually often knew this, because they played golf with these people and had a drink with them, meals with them, and they were socialized with them.
Mm-hmm.
This was very crucial intelligence service. And all carried in people's heads, not written down.
Did you feel it was necessary to have a pretty good grasp of the way the actual stock exchange worked as a market, and a pretty good grasp of the way that, say, the single capacity system worked, and what a jobber did, what he couldn't do, what was reasonable to ask him to
do? No, not too much. Not too much. Jobbers didn't really come our way very much. I mean, we'd sometimes say to a stockbroker, righto, well, we want to do this, and it's a big and tricky operation. This is vaguely what we want to do. We're not in too much hurry. You go and talk to the jobbers. Because, of course, we never talked to the jobbers. That was a golden rule. On one or two occasions when somehow we did get involved with jobbers, it was usually disastrous.
Mm.
Because they're doing their own, they were doing their own thing.
Mm.
Their objectives were perfectly clear, and our objectives were also perfectly clear, that they should make as little money as possible.
Mm. In general terms, what kind of situation would you have been referring to when you said on the one or two occasions you got involved there'd been disasters?
Well, when you discovered that perhaps a jobber was had a particular interest in something or particular line. I mean, and when I say only once or twice in a long period of time, I really do mean once or twice. I don't mean 10 or 12 times. Of course, it's all a long time ago now, and I don't remember details. But yeah, we had no dealings with jobbers at all. We'd occasionally tell our stockbrokers, that we didn't mind them talking to the jobbers. And of course, this was the great advantage of the old system. They could just go down to the stock exchange floor and somebody they trusted again and knew well, they could actually talk to and say, well, I've got a client that wants to do this and he's left it with us to fix up. And the two of them would get together.
Yes. Were your fund managers at liberty to choose the brokers they could work with?
Yes. We didn't have... partly because of reciprocal business in the unit trust world, do you understand what I'm talking about? If stockbrokers bought your units or your insurance policies, you tried to give them business to, because M&G didn't always pay commission to compensate. But this has always been held against unit trusts, reciprocal commission, that they didn't go to the best brokers, they were just compensating. This was a very small part of the story, in fact, in relating to M&G. Our objective was, if possible, to deal with virtually all the firms of brokers and all over the country. Because of the information they had, particularly in the provinces of specialized information, partly because in every firm there was always one good individual, by definition. And I was just keen that the managers should go to people they trusted and who were well informed. And I mean, I used to see all the details, and the board used to see, I think every 6 months, the list of the brokers and who had commission. And very occasionally one would say, oh, why is so much business being given to X? Yeah, so there was monitoring, that there was no footy-footy going on, and kickbacks or anything like that. Yeah.
Would you have said this was true of most investment institutions, that they would use the whole range?
No, I'm saying that it wasn't true. M&G, I think, was not unique, but I think we were very rare in dealing with everybody. No, most institutions had a list of 12 or 24, usually 12 brokers that they mostly dealt with. No.
And did this reflect a different dealing philosophy? You mentioned earlier that your fund managers had a fair degree of independence in managing their own particular funds.
Yeah, it reflected that, yes. And it reflected a desire to accumulate information. We were much better at it than MI5.
Now, you've already said that it was a firm rule with you that there was no contact with the jobbers.
Yeah.
Again, would you have said that was fairly true of most institutions in the city?
Yeah, I would have think so. I would think so. I would have thought about 90%, 95%, but very occasionally you heard of setups between investment houses and jobbers. But I think that was quite rare.
Would you ever meet them on a social basis, in the sense that, a broker's lunch?
Occasionally, not very often, surprisingly enough. The only reason that we ever met brokers, jobbers, was because they dealt, the jobbers dealt in our units, because we were the only units that were quoted on the stock exchange. M&G was unique in that, and still is unique, in having their units quoted on the stock exchange, like any investment trust or. So occasionally we would meet the jobbers to talk about how they made markets in our units and whether we were giving them the right information and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
How conscious of were you of the jobbing as the jobbing system rather than as the jobbing firms? For example, one of the things that I suppose was a feature of the system during the 60s and 70s was the amalgamation and merger of firms. I mean, in part because of the rise of the institutional investors, that was changing the whole nature of the investing environment. Were there issues that you ever found yourself conscious
of? Well, I think
of?
We wanted more jobbers than there were in the end. But the irony of the thing is that the three big jobbers in the end, which were Wedds and Aykroyd and Smiths, are in fact still the three biggest market makers. And despite all the fuss and bother, they still remain very influential. But the trouble is now that, of course, they are stockbrokers as well as jobbers, and market makers, and it's all. And so all this talk about Big Bang leading to more liquid markets is a load of absolute codswallop. Because, as I understand it, it's much more difficult now to deal in second-line stocks than it was before. And, I mean, there's huge activity goes on in alpha stocks, and they whiz around, but, no, it's no different from. No, that's no different.
Why was it that you would have liked more jobbers towards the end of single competition?
Well, I think just to give more competition. I think three or. Of course, one did disappear. Pinch and Denny disappeared. Yeah, the fourth biggest. Because it went into Morgan Grenfell, I think, and then that all disappeared. Three is. There were some small jobbers, but three big ones were too small. And there was always the argument that they couldn't get enough capital. But I think that was a load of nonsense. If anybody had turned their minds to it, they could have raised more capital if they wanted to.
Well, that's an issue that's come up quite frequently in a lot of the interviews I've conducted. Have you got any idea how they could have done that?
Oh.
Because I noticed that in the reports of your comments, say during 1984-85, this is a comment that you make, that you didn't think the capital issue was one that was particularly insuperable. And a firm
Did
like
I say that?
Yes.
Good Lord. Well, I still don't think so. I mean, my experience is that if there's a good story to tell, people can always raise money, and I think it was made as an excuse. I've never shifted on that. Aykroyd became a public company, didn't it?
Yes.
And I mean, they could have geared up and borrowed, and banks are there occasionally to help, which is something one tends to forget. And they would have, and I think other institutions. Yeah, I would have. I can remember saying to some jobber. It was quite interesting, actually. We were one of the first investors. I don't mean M&G itself, but one of our funds invested in Smith Brothers when Smith Brothers went public. After about 6 or 9 months, we started getting representations that they thought other people in the market thought there was a conflict of interest here, that we should be funneling all our business through brokers, and we'd give instructions to brokers that they had to deal through Smith Brothers. Of course, that was a load of cock too. But we did, in fact, sell our shareholding in Smith Brothers so that nobody could say that. But we, of course, never knew which jobbing firm had been used. You bought a million ICI through Cazenove or somebody, and you never knew which jobber Cazenove went to. But I mean, there was no need to know, and it was total bore. All one was interested in was whether they'd dealt properly.
Well, did you feel with the fewer firms that in fact you were dealing at as competitive prices as you could be?
Well, I never thought they were bad. I mean, the thing that was wrong, of course, was the Stock Exchange built their own poo trap to fall into, that they were so slow in adjusting their commission scales. And indeed, they could have adjusted their commission scales very much more easily, particularly on gilts, but for size and continuation and everything like that, without having to go through all the fuss of Big Bang. And I was at this conference yesterday about short-termism and all this jazz, where the subject came up that these commissions of 0.2% or a quarter or something that the institutions are getting now. The answer is, of course, that if you pay such low commissions, you get a bloody awful service. And some of the institutions simply aren't getting the research, because we never had any cause to complain about the standard of research one got. I mean, we paid quite large fees, and I reckon we got jolly good value for money from most brokers. And if you didn't get good value for money from a broker, you just didn't deal with them. And so that was a pity.
When did commissions start to be a concern among fund managers?
Well, it was a concern, I suppose, about 1980 it really started becoming a concern. Fueled, of course, by the merchant banks, who wanted to get in on the act, and who behaved, as merchant banks always behave, in their own interests. And of course, they were tremendously behind the whole subject of Big Bang, because they wanted to get in on the act. The fact that when they did get in on the act, they made a complete balls up of it is one of the ironies and pleasures of life. Because not many of them have made any money out of becoming stockbrokers and market makers. So it's quite funny. I mean, anybody who ever took the trouble to ask me, and a few of them did, and took precious little notice, I'd tell them exactly what was going to happen, and indeed it has. So you're talking to somebody who's grinding his own axe, I'm afraid.
One of the things the institutions were criticised for was to create a much more one-way market. Many people have said that formerly, when there was a greater mix of private investors and big institutions, you had much more of a two-way business. And so it was a lot easier for a jobber to turn over his stock and to make a market. How would you have responded to that sort of criticism?
Oh, I think that's absolutely a fair criticism. I mean, the irony, too, use that word again, was that all the time I was at M&G, obviously, it was in M&G's interest that the more people who came into unit trusts, the better. But from the point of view of marketability of securities, the fewer people that had centralized, used unit trusts or pension funds and that sort of thing, the better. Because, in fact, the thing that moved markets always was 12 deals in 1,000 shares, rather than one deal in 250,000. The jobbers could sort that out. But when the sentiment was all one way, of a lot of small deals all one way, it was that shifted market. And strange enough, you always saw that at election times. You know, there'd suddenly be a weight of money from a lot of small people who'd sense the way an election was going. But they're much more influential, and the decline of the private investor is really bad news for everybody. And that seems to be getting worse and worse.
Did you ever feel it was the kind of size in which institutions often wanted to deal was in fact an unreasonable demand to place on any market, in the sense that they were such large chunks of stock that they could not easily be absorbed and then passed on?
No, I was always amazed how efficient the jobbing system was at dealing with it. I mean, occasionally you get absolutely stuck in something when people just actually wouldn't want to buy it. Jolly good reasons, but it meant the seller was right. But on the whole, no, the market was quite efficient at the art of dealing with it was to say, right, oh, well, if you can get rid of, say, 5 million quid's worth of something quickly, I will take a discount of 2 or 3%. And then how the jobber dealt with that, either passing it straight on or taking it on his book and trying to get a turn, was entirely his concern. All I was interested in was getting rid of the stock. And on the whole,
did you ever have cases of brokers coming back to fund managers saying, well, you know, we've got someone who's prepared to deal in 50,000, but they won't do the whole 200?
Oh yes, one had that, and one would say, I mean, depending on the sort of character of the manager, and whether he wanted the cash or whether he was a patient sort, or whether he was an impetuous sort like I was, I'd usually say, oh, I'd do the 50. But there were other people who'd say, right, oh, well, I'll wait till I can do the whole lot, because I don't want the market moving against me on the other 150. It depended very much how badly he needed the cash to do something else. And so different people would deal with this in different ways, yes. And that quite often happened, yes.
One of the things that I believe soured relations between brokers and jobbers during the 70s was the greater incidence of put-throughs and brokers trying to match orders. Did you have any particular view on that? Were you bothered whether a broker went into the market and made a sort of a transaction direct with a jobber, or whether the broker was trying to match the business?
Occasionally you got bitching on this subject, but I think it was probably fair that if a broker had a line of 1 million shares, he should go to the jobber who'd have the first call, because otherwise you have the danger that the jobber's only there for things that are really difficult. And I don't think that's fair, and that was restricting. And of course the institutions thought that they were being terribly clever by trying to squeeze the jobber out. I think that attitude of mind is always wrong. If you're getting a good service from somebody, I'm quite prepared to pay for it. And I mean, it's like if you've got a solicitor, for goodness sake, and you want good legal advice, don't go to a cut price. I mean, if the advice is going to be good, I don't really. It's just like if somebody's going to cut me up. I don't care what I pay the surgeon, as long as he cuts me up efficiently. You know, and I think this applies to barristers and land agents and everything. And I think there was this idea around that it was terribly clever to squeeze commissions and squeeze money on put-throughs and things. And in fact, I don't think it is terribly clever.
How did you feel about a fund manager taking a large order, breaking it into smaller chunks, and then sending different brokers into the market, which is something I believe occasionally happens?
Yeah, that was a bloody stupid thing to do. Mm. Because, of course, they were then bidding against each other. I mean, yeah. No, you never do that.
Did that ever figure as a, an issue in any way, either with...
Well, we would never do that. And I used to get cross in the office if by any chance, you know, two managers were selling a share and they were dealing with different brokers. In any large organization with lots of people involved, there are always things that go wrong, and that's the sort of thing that could go wrong. But that was thoroughly undesirable. What isn't, what was, how we did it was, we'd say to Hawes or somebody like this, right, up, here's a £5 million order, which we want you to do the whole lot, but we shall ask you to pass on a bit of commission to the